sure I'm one. So we spent the last year in our Sunday services going through a systematic study of Bible doctrine. So we had sermons on various subjects of what the Bible teaches. And we concluded that last Sunday, and we are beginning a new study here this morning, a study through the book of Philippians. So we will begin here in Philippians chapter 1 with verse 1. This, of course, is message number 1 in this series and is entitled Letter from a Roman Prisoner. Philippians chapter 1, verse number 1. Paul and Timotheus, the servants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ Jesus which are at Philippi, with the bishops and deacons. So, before there was a WhatsApp, or Snapchat, or DMs, or text messages, or email, now some people are starting to kick in a little bit, you know what I'm talking about, fax, cellular or landline phones, even before there were typewriters, there were handwritten letters. I know that's funny to think about. But if you wanted to communicate with someone that was not in the same place as you are, you had to put pen to paper, or of course, quill to parchment, depending on how far back we're talking. You had to write a letter. You had to send it in some way. Then you had to wait. So the letter would have to be carried to another city or across the sea, and possibly taking a very long time, getting lost. Then it would take time again if you were expecting a response. They would have to receive it. Then they would have to write a letter, and then they would have to send it. Now, of course, today we can call and we can leave a voicemail or we can send a text message. And of course, we get irritated if someone doesn't respond immediately. Within a few seconds, we think that's how that works because that's the way that all these technologies work. But it certainly wasn't that way in the first century. So in the early 60s of the first century A.D. in Rome, if you found yourself in prison, let's say, and even if it was a sort of a house arrest, you did not have the civil right of one phone call. Now, of course, American citizens are protected by the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of having a right to make one phone call after you have been arrested and booked. But you didn't have that in the first century A.D. because there were no phones, for one thing. But you could write letters. Now, Paul the Apostle was arrested in Jerusalem, and he spent 2 years imprisoned in Caesarea. He finally appealed his case to Caesar in Rome, and so he was transferred to Rome, arriving there in about the year 60 A.D., and he was confined to a rented house before being released later in 62 A.D. Now, the book of Acts ends with Paul imprisoned in Rome and preaching the gospel to all that would visit and would hear him, and of course, writing letters. In fact, from this imprisonment, he wrote 4 letters of the New Testament. So earlier in the imprisonment, there were 3 letters, the letter to the church at Ephesus, the letter to the church at Colossae, and the letter to the man named Philemon, who was a member of the church at Colossae, and in fact hosted the assembly of the church in Colossae in his house. Now, the letters to the church at Ephesus and the church at Colossae were written right around the same time. They are very similar, a lot of similarities between those letters. But later in his imprisonment in Rome, Paul wrote this letter to the church at Philippi that we refer to as the Epistle of Philippians. And the letter to the church in Philippi is, of course, somewhat unique from those other letters that Paul wrote. And so it's this letter to the church at Philippi that we are beginning to study with this message here this morning. Now, Philippi was a Roman colony city. It was in the province of Macedonia in what is now known as northern Greece. The city was named after Philip II of Macedon, who was the father of Alexander the Great. Being a Roman colony and near to the site of a famous battle, the Battle of Philippi, the city had a large presence of active duty Roman soldiers as well as retired Roman soldiers and their families. Now, Paul's time in Philippi is recorded in the New Testament in the book of Acts in chapter number 16. Paul and his companions were in Troas. Troas was a port city on the northwest shore of the province of Asia. And while they were there in Troas, Paul saw a vision, and there was a man from Macedonia asking Paul to come over and to help them. And so immediately they left. They sailed across the Aegean Sea, some 140 miles to Neapolis, and then walked the 10 miles to the city of Philippi there in the province of Macedonia. Now, the city of Philippi didn't have a large Jewish population, and you know that when Paul would go about from place to place, the first thing he would do would be find a synagogue, go to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and speak to the Jews there concerning who Jesus Christ was and how he's the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies. Well, the city didn't have a large Jewish population because there was no synagogue in Philippi at that time. So that means that there were less than 10 Jewish men residing in that city. So Paul went to the river outside of the city on the Sabbath day to meet any Jews or Gentile God-fearers from the city who would meet by the river for prayers and such. And what Paul met was a small group of women there by the river on that Sabbath day. And Paul preached the gospel of Jesus Christ to them. And Paul's first convert that day was a businesswoman named Lydia, whose heart, we're told, the Lord opened up to believe the things that Paul preached. She believed on Jesus Christ. Now, as Paul continued in the city of Philippi, there was a young slave girl who was possessed by a demon. And this young slave girl was following Paul and his companions around, and she was crying out about them and about their message of salvation. And so Paul suffered this, it says. He put up with it for many days. We don't know exactly how long, but eventually Paul turned and faced her and cast the demon out of her. And of course, once he did that, now this girl was nothing more than just a common slave girl. She was good for, you know, washing pots and household chores and whatever else. But her owners were actually a group of businessmen in the city of Philippi. And they had made a lot of money off of this slave girl because she was possessed of this demon. And they used her as a medium. And they would make a lot of money through her divinations and what have you. But of course, with the demon gone from her, she no longer was useful for that at all. And so they were very upset, needless to say. They raised a riot against Paul and Silas there in the city. They forced them into the open court in the city where they accused them of disturbing the peace and also of teaching an illegal religion. Now, the rulers had to act very quickly because this was obviously a mob scene. It's very chaotic. There's a lot of noise. And so, obviously, this public outcry has to be put down immediately. They don't want to get in trouble with the Roman Empire. And so, they had Paul and Silas flogged publicly and then thrown into prison. And, of course, while in prison, about midnight, there was an earthquake that shook the jail, the hill that the prison was on, and it freed all of the prisoners to the great dismay of the jailer. But Paul assured him that all the prisoners were still there. And then they preached Jesus to this jailer in Philippi, and he believed, just like Lydia had done, and later with others of his house. So the next day, the rulers of the city there in Philippi, they wanted to release Paul and Silas so that they would essentially leave town. You know, they've been scolded, they've been beaten, they've been thrown in prison for a night. Obviously, given their freedom, they're going to get out of town at the first opportunity that they have. Now, the problem was that when they sent some guards to convey this news, Paul refused. Because he was, in fact, a Roman citizen. And while Paul was not protected by the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, Paul did have the right of a Roman citizen. That meant they could not be flogged except under very specific conditions. So it wasn't that a Roman citizen could never be flogged or subject to that penalty, but it could only happen under certain specific conditions. And one of those conditions that it was legal to so publicly beat a Roman citizen, one of those conditions was only after a due process of full legal trial where guilt was established and a sentence was given, which is something Paul and Silas had not received. So those actions were indeed illegal and had violated their rights as Roman citizens. Well, once the rulers learned this, they, of course, were very nervous, and they came personally. They came very apologetically to Paul and Silas, and they did agree to leave the city. But first, they stopped at Lydia's house to speak with her and the new church before leaving Philippi, and then they would ultimately come on to Thessalonica and continue on. Now, these events in Philippi had happened about 10 years earlier than the time that Paul is writing this letter to the church in Philippi. He's writing from house arrest in Rome. And in fact, Paul refers to his imprisonment by the time you get to verses 13 and 14 in chapter 1. Paul is referring to the fact that he is a prisoner at the time that he's writing. He also refers to some people of Caesar's household in chapter 4 and verse 22, which makes Rome, again, the most likely place that Paul was writing from. Now, the occasion for the letter, what was it that gave rise for this letter to be written? Well, that becomes plain by the end of chapter number 2. You see, the church at Philippi had sent money to Paul while he was in prison. And they had sent it by one of the church members there in Philippi, a man by the name of Epaphroditus. And Epaphroditus had carried this from Philippi to Rome, which would have been a journey of over 700 miles to get this to Paul. And at some point, and we don't know if this was while he was traveling or while he was there with Paul, but at some point, Epaphroditus became sick. And in fact, his illness was discovered to be a serious, life-threatening illness to which they thought that he was going to die. And Epaphroditus was with Paul, and he was sick enough, and he was sick long enough, that news had actually gone back to Philippi that of the condition that he was in, and they were very concerned for him, understandably. Well, Epaphroditus recovered, and he gained health enough to be able to return to Philippi. And when he returned, he carried this letter in his hands back to the church at Philippi. So this occasion gave Paul a great opportunity to write to this church in Philippi. And he had a few different reasons or purposes in writing to them. Now, obviously, on one hand, Paul was very thankful for the church. And as you read this letter and you see what Paul says about them and the way that he refers to them, even in other places, it's apparent that there was a very close relationship and a lot of love between Paul and between this church in Philippi. And obviously he was very thankful for the church, and he refers to how they many times had given support to Paul, and they were always supportive of Paul in prayer and also in money, in gifts and things that Paul needed. Paul was extremely thankful for this church, and so he expresses that thankfulness in this letter that was sent by Epaphroditus. And Paul also wanted to acknowledge Epaphroditus. So as you look at in chapter 2, you see that he urges the church in Philippi to receive him and to honor him. And he speaks so well of him. And, you know, Epaphroditus was this basically a servant of the church. He performed a very menial task, but Paul speaks of him in the highest of terms and urges that they love him and that they honor him for the service that he has done, and also that they would follow his example, which is something we'll talk more about later. Paul also, in this letter, gives them an update. I'm sure that they are concerned, that they've been in communication with Paul as much as is possible. Obviously, the sickness of Epaphroditus hindered that somewhat, But Paul wants to update them on his situation in Rome, and he does so in this letter. But what other purposes did Paul have for writing this letter? And that brings us to consider the content of the letter itself. And we want to know what this letter communicates. But first, we have to know how this letter communicates. And so that's where we will begin, with considering the type of writing the letter to the Philippians represents. Now, when I talk about the type of writing, I'm talking about what could be called a literary category or a genre of literature, if you prefer that term. In other words, it tells us how the message of a written composition is communicated. So it makes a difference if something is written in verse, if it's written in poetry, if it's written in song, if it's written in allegory or parable or many other ways that they can be written. So when we look at the Bible, we realize that the Bible is a collection of books and that there are many different types of compositions within the Bible. For instance, the book of Psalms, which we have been studying on Wednesday nights, going psalm by psalm. Psalms is poetry. And so because it is poetry, it communicates its message that way. And it gives it the shape, it gives it the structure, the way that it is communicated, but it also gives us the key to understanding how that we read the Psalms. How should we read the Psalms and expect it to communicate the message? Genesis, on the other hand, is a book that we call historical narrative. So it is giving us these historical accounts of these different events and things that happened and these different people and the times that they lived and the things that occurred. But it is still yet conveying a message to us, but that is how it's getting that message to us. So when we look at Philippians, we understand that Philippians is what we would call a literary epistle and is what we would call a letter, and I do think we need both terms. An epistle is something that is written in the style of a letter, but it is a little more formal, and it is a little more stylistic than a purely personal letter. So if you were writing a letter, for instance, that was maybe some business letter, you're contacting some company about some issue or what have you, then you're going to do so in a certain way that's going to be very different than the way, say, you were writing your mother a quick letter just to update her on maybe some news and events of what's going on. Those two letters would look very different. They would have different styles to them. So an epistle is what is also more of a public communication. So it is a letter, and it is addressed sometimes to an individual or to a group of individuals, like a church in Philippi, which this is addressed to. But even so, it is written with the intention that it's going to be read by others and that it is applicable to others as well. Now, when I say that Philippians is a letter, I mean that it is a personal communication. So when you read the letter to the Philippians, you'll realize that it has a warm and a friendly tone. It's even affectionate, depending on the relationship of the writer and the recipients, as we said, which can be discerned with Paul and the Philippians. And letters, these sort of letters, they tend to include items of interest, such as personal updates and travel plans and sending of greetings to friends or others that may be an acquaintance and what have you. So when we look at the letter to the Philippians, we realize that we get a blend of both of these. We get a public type epistle that is addressed to a church, and we also get a personal letter that is written to a group of close friends of Paul the Apostle. Now, letters in the Greco-Roman world of the first century, they did have certain conventions that the biblical epistles conform to. And I don't know if they still teach this in school or not, but when I was in school, you know, you were given the standard forms of letters and how to write and, you know, where you put the address and where you put the date and then, you know, the body of the letter and what that's supposed to have and then how you end it and all that sort of thing. I mean, we were taught to do that in a matter of form. You know, is it a business letter? Is it a personal letter? Whatever that it is. And so the letters in the Greco-Roman world were really no different. They had certain conventions. And the letters in the New Testament, they do conform to that. So, but the New Testament letters also have what we might say further standards because of their spiritual nature. So in this, Philippians is a standard letter. It has a salutation, it has a body, it has a conclusion. It includes the various elements that we expect in biblical epistles. It has thanksgiving and prayers. In this case, it has missionary updates from Paul. It gives some manner of theological instruction and practical exhortation, and also personal greetings. But not all of the New Testament epistles are equal. For example, if we look at the letter to the Romans, well, it is really what we would call an essay letter. Romans has a structure that is defined by the logical flow of Paul's tightly reasoned explanation of the gospel and justification by faith. And so it builds and builds and builds and builds and unfolds as you go from beginning to end of that letter. 1 Corinthians, on the other hand, is different from Romans. 1 Corinthians is what we would call a topical letter. And it is structured by the questions that the church in Corinth had sent to Paul. And so he's answering and addressing these questions. It's also structured by certain circumstances within the church at Corinth that needs to be addressed. And so Paul is also addressing those. And again, that's quite different from the letter to the Romans. Well, then when we come to Philippians, for instance, it isn't like Romans or 1 Corinthians. It's different. It is what we would more call a conversational letter. So it's reasonable that we read these personal elements in here. We read this warm tone. The letter gives evidence of this close relationship between Paul and the church. So this letter is more personal and it is more conversational. Well, a personal letter is a letter that is freer in style than, say, a business letter or even maybe an urgent letter that would be written because of some urgent need or some urgent matter that needed correction or what have you. Now, the writer of a personal letter writes with warmth and also writes as thoughts occurred. All right. So if you can go way back in your mind to writing and reading handwritten letters, personal letters, family, friends, what have you. Well, you know that that's the case. You know, you take the pen and the paper and you start writing. And you're sort of writing as thoughts occur to you. And so it sometimes those letters can kind of go around in circles. They can kind of meander. And it's basically like having just a friendly chat on the phone, reading that kind of a personal letter. Well, of course, there was no copy and paste in those days. There was no delete and move, the things that we can do with the use of computers and such now. And so the letters that are personal letters, friendly letters like this, are not logically organized with clear transitions, but rather they're letters that sort of move from topic to topic and not necessarily being connected between them. Now, many scholars and commentators have noticed that there are some abrupt seams in this letter to the Philippians, and some have concluded that there may be three different letters that were written at different times, and they've sort of all been patched together and sent by Epaphroditus without being smoothed over. But really, if we recognize that Philippians is not the letter to the Romans, and it is not, and we recognize that there's a personal nature and style to this letter, then it's just far more likely that Paul writes in a freer style and the letter is indeed a whole composition. I don't think we have any need to worry about that. So recognizing Philippians as an epistle with personal elements doesn't mean that it is not a unified whole letter. Now, when we talked about Romans, and we studied through Romans not too awful long ago that we finished that, Romans is a tightly reasoned teaching letter that is unified by the theme of justification by faith. Well, Philippians is not that type of a letter. But that doesn't mean that it's not unified by a controlling theme. So a unifying or controlling theme is one theme that dominates over all the letter and connects all of the themes together in a unified whole. So what is the unifying theme of Philippians? Well, a good clue to looking for themes in not just books of the Bible, but books in general or articles or essays or whatever that they might be, is looking for those repetitions. So, for instance, Philippians, Paul refers to the gospel in some way around 10 different times in this letter. So that could possibly be the theme. Philippians refers to Christ numerous times and puts him as the exemplar of the Christian faith. So that certainly could be a theme. Paul refers to joy in some way or another around about 20 times in this letter. And this is a very short letter, and so that is a remarkable number of times that Paul says something about joy, rejoicing, or what have you. And many people center and key on joy as being that unifying theme of the letter. So this is a short letter, and those are certainly themes in the letter. But is one of those the unifying theme? Well, I think not. Paul uses the word for think in this letter about a dozen times. And in fact, it's the Greek word phroneo, or that comes from the root friend. And it's a word that means to dispose the mind in a certain way, to focus one's attention to. Now, the fact that he uses this so often in this short letter is remarkable, and it is unique in the New Testament epistles. And Paul is clearly writing to the church in Philippi so that they will have a certain mindset, that they will think and set their minds the way that Jesus Christ does. In fact, a central key verse, Philippians chapter 2 and verse number 5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. So this is the unifying theme that binds all together, having the mind of Christ. And so this letter flows from all of that and results in the right mindset. So in other words, when we talk about joy, it is certainly a theme in the letter, but where does joy come from? Well, as we read the letter, we realize it comes from the right mindset. Having the mind of Christ is where the joy that Paul talks about in Philippians comes from. And we could go on down talking about humility and other aspects, things that Paul mentions in this letter. Where do they come from? It comes from having the mind of Christ. And we also, when we think about those people that Paul mentions, he gives his own personal examples. And some have observed that Paul gives more autobiographical information in Philippians than in any other single letter. Well, he also talks about Timothy, and he also talks about Epaphroditus, and he talks about Jesus Christ, especially in that great section in chapter number 2. And why is he talking about them? They are all being examples to the Philippians of having the right mindset. Jesus, of course, being the supreme exemplar of that. And that is the reason I've, in fact, entitled this series of sermons, Think Like Jesus. That's the title of our study of the book of Philippians that we are beginning this morning. So now we want to turn to the message of Philippians. What is it communicating? So the unifying theme of Philippians is have the mind of Christ, or think like Jesus. Paul explains the Christian calling in this letter as being a call to live and to die like Jesus Christ. So Philippians, then, is a letter that answers those persistent questions. What are our lives for? What should I do with my life? What should I do with the time that I have upon this earth? And secondly, how should we live? How should we conduct ourselves? How should we view the world around us and interact with others and other believers and so on? Now, in exhorting the Philippians and all Christians to have the mind of Christ, Paul reveals what we should have and what we should avoid. So thinking like Jesus will give us a focus on the gospel. There's going to be a certain priority to the gospel of Jesus Christ in our lives. Paul understood the gospel to be more important than his personal circumstances, even though he was bound as a prisoner when writing this letter. In fact, he spoke about those who were trying to make his suffering worse by preaching Christ. And Paul said, "Nevertheless, I'm going to rejoice that Christ is being preached. Even if it maybe makes my situation worse, I'm going to be thankful and I'm going to rejoice that the gospel is going to more people." Well, that's a focus on the gospel. So the gospel should give a certain shape to our lives, and it should guide us in the decisions that we make, and it should inform us of how we view our own circumstances and the world around us. Also, thinking like Jesus will give us fellowship with the saints. If we are not always seeking our own in life, then we will have more compassion and we will have more unity with fellow believers. As Paul writes in this letter, we should seek the good of others. We should not put our own opinions and preferences first in all things. Paul refers, in fact, to two women in the church, Yodia and Syntyche, that he mentions, and they were having some sort of squabble. And Paul doesn't tell us what they were squabbling about, and he doesn't tell us who's right and who's wrong. He tells both of them that they need to have the same mind, the mind of Christ. You both need to think like Jesus, and this squabble will be over. Also, when we think like Jesus, it will fortify us against enemies. In the letter to the Philippians, Paul refers to possibly four different groups that were opposing Paul and opposing the church in Philippi, otherwise teaching false doctrine or having false motives in what they were doing. Thinking like Jesus will also free us from pride. It isn't natural for us to think of others above ourselves. It isn't natural for us to take the lowest place. Now, there are a few examples of this in the letter, but the ultimate example, of course, is Jesus himself, that Paul says took on the human form and became a slave in order to give himself for others in obedience to God that called for his death. And he did not think of himself too highly to do that. Thinking like Jesus will also give us fulfillment in life, which means joy and contentment. Now, it's hard to imagine Paul writing from prison because the letter seems so upbeat and so energetic. The letter seems so positive. And again, references to joy and rejoicing over 20 times in just this short letter. So it's almost hard to imagine that Paul is in dire conditions in any way. In fact, conditions that he believes may very likely end in his death. And it didn't at that time, but it did a few years later. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that Paul is detached from life. It doesn't mean that Paul's just living on some higher plane floating above the mere mortals and their little puny interests and pains and concerns. No, he refers to suffering. He refers to suffering affliction. He refers to suffering poverty. No, it is very real. Paul had experienced having plenty. He had experienced being able to lay down and to go to sleep at night without worrying about needing something that he did not have or have any way to get. But Paul also experienced lacking what he needed. He also experienced going to bed knowing that he needed something he didn't have and didn't have the ability to get, not knowing where it was going to come from. And he was thankful for the church in Philippi. He was thankful for how they had supported him, possibly one of his most faithfully supporting churches. But he also used this opportunity to speak to them about contentment, those times when he didn't have what he needed. Now, it might seem that Philippians is purely practical, and it is a very, very practical letter, but it is theologically rich. Now, it doesn't have the logical arguments of Romans again, but it does have one of the clearest, most profound statements of the deity of Jesus Christ in the Bible that we find here in chapter number 2. Paul also does refer to the future and the return of Jesus Christ and the expectation of that return. He speaks of the Christian citizenship being in heaven and not upon the earth. So Philippians is a very relevant book even to us today. And in fact, it's a message that is sorely needed in our day. Because for one thing, understanding Philippians should help us focus our minds on the truth, goodness, and beauty of Jesus Christ and His Word. And we may live in the most distracted age in history to this point. There are so many things clamoring for our attention. And you go back to the Proverbs and Solomon's warning about all these voices that you're going to meet out there, my son. And you need to bind these words around your neck. You need to have them in your heart. They'll be a lamp. They'll be a light to guide you. So Philippians is a letter in the New Testament that cuts through all of that clutter and all of that noise and all of that distraction and says, this is how you need to think. You need to think like Jesus. So again, a very relevant message in our time. It helps us understand the place of Christ in our lives and our relationship to other believers and to the world around us. Very relevant and needed message for our day.